Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, July 16th, 2018. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined Paddleboard Paradise on Lake Decatur, a yoga variation encouraging standing tall. Aaron Rockefeller and Melanie Snively ride the waves on Lake Decatur as often as they can. It is really peaceful to get out on the lake and get away from the chaos of everyday life, Rockefeller said. It is also a nice workout. The opportunities to be on the water are more available with standing paddleboard instructor Abby McIntosh. McIntosh and her husband Aaron have a love of the water and an understanding about popular water sports, so the couple introduced Decatur to a new activity. People wanted to know about kayak, Abby McIntosh said, but paddleboarding was not known here. While the couple and their family were visiting relatives in Florida 7 years ago, they learned about paddleboards, so we brought one back to Clinton Lake, Abby said. They moved to Decatur 4 years ago from Weldon because they saw an interest in the water activity here. To network with other people, the couple started a Facebook page and found people around Decatur were interested in the same thing. Since no paddleboard companies existed in central Illinois, the McIntoshes decided to start one. They were aware of Decatur and the recreational opportunities, having created signs through their company for the Decatur Park District. Abby McIntosh said they came to Decatur because she saw a need for people to be on the water. This beautiful lake was here, Abby McIntosh said. There is a misconception about the lake being dirty. She said her job is just to introduce people to the water. We set people up for a better day, she said. According to Abby McIntosh, time on a paddleboard builds confidence. The couple often hear people's worries about being able to accomplish the tasks of standing and moving through the water. But there is something in them that wants to do it, she said. They go out and come back with a smile on their face. Then they are set up for success the rest of the day. Aaron McIntosh said the paddleboards are designed for easy balance. If you keep your head over the center of the board, you're fine, he said. He said the recreational activity has its challenges. People do fall off regularly, he said. One of the biggest obstacles the McIntoshes see is the trepidation in first-timers. They are a little shaking, but they come back saying, "This is fantastic," Aaron McIntosh said. Snively, 26, attends the McIntoshes' paddleboard yoga classes as often as she can. It uses muscles that don't normally get used, she said. The instructors are patient with their students no matter the skill level. Rockefeller, 36, is not new to paddleboard yoga, but she has found herself in the water after doing a particularly challenging pose, like the warrior pose. If a wave comes in, it kind of knocks you off the board, she said, but it is very refreshing when you fall in the water. If you are out there in the sun and it is a little warm, it feels good, and it is a soft landing. Safety is a concern on the water. The McIntoshes make sure participants wear life jackets, leg leashes attached to the boards, and they go over pointers on how to maneuver the board. We have also had a lot of great support from Lake Patrol, Abby McIntosh said. Snively often brings visiting family and friends to the lake. Every time my friends come into town, we do this, she said. It is a really fun way to get on the lake and enjoy what Decatur has already. Aaron McIntosh said he loves the athletic challenges he has on the paddleboard, as well as the opportunities to introduce the activity to others, but he also appreciates the tranquility he finds on the lake. The view of the sky changing colors can bring the experienced paddleboarder a sense of peace. We just hang and watch, he said. The sky is just gorgeous. And this article was part of the Together Decatur series. If you know a person or a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur, contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983. Continuing on the front page, Western Edge of Early American Wars. Historic battles have taken place at Rock Island Area Site. This is part of the Illinois Bicentennial Series. The Quad Cities region has provided an important footnote to history for virtually every war fought on American soil, including the Battle of Campbell's Island, the westernmost battle of the War of 1812. According to the records of Indian historian John Hauberg, as the French and Indian War ended, the last of the French soldiers of the Northwest spent the winter of 1760-61 near present-day Rock Island, icebound on their retreat from Michilimackinac to Fort Chartres, Illinois, following the British conquest of Canada. All Indian villages in the Upper Mississippi and Great Lakes were canvassed by British agents to enlist Indians for fighting in the frontier during the Revolutionary War. The Americans, even before General George Rogers Clark conquered the Illinois country in July 1778, had agents who had succeeded in keeping the Sauk and Meskwaki from joining the British ranks. With the arrival of Clark, messengers were sent to all of the tribes, inviting them to come to Cahokia to join in treaties of peace. According to the writings of Hauberg, the Sauk held to the middle ground, trading with the British, but also with the Spanish at St. Louis and with the Americans in Illinois. In 1780, the British hatched a plan to retake the entire Mississippi Valley. Representatives of all tribes were forced to serve. The first attack was at St. Louis, but according to some accounts, the Sauk and Meskwaki held back. Other Indians, fearing a rear attack from them, held back too, and the grand scheme of conquest failed. Clark wanted to punish those who had aided the British. In 1780, Lieutenant Colonel John Montgomery and 350 men came up the Illinois River to Peoria, then to the Sauk village of Saukanuck, the modern-day site of Rock Island, on the Rock River. One report said 700 Sauk warriors withdrew without resistance and watched as the Americans burned their village. According to reports by Hauberg, the Sauk, who had been America's friend, had been mistaken for the enemy. While history is uncertain on this point, this may have been the westernmost battle of the Revolutionary War. In July 1814, during the war with Britain, an expedition led by Lieutenant John Campbell was heading north in 5 keelboats to reinforce and resupply the U.S. fort at Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, and stopped at Rock Island. They spent two days eating and drinking with the warrior Black Hawk and his men, and the Americans became friendly with the Indians. In his autobiography, translated by Antoine LeClaire and edited by J.B. Patterson, Black Hawk said they had no intention of hurting the Americans, but during the night, the British arrived down the Rock River with 6 kegs of powder and told them that the British had taken the fort at Prairie du Chien and wished for the Sauk to join them in the war, which they agreed to do. The next morning, July 19, 1814, Black Hawk and 500 braves were hidden along the river as the American expedition entered the head of the Mississippi River's dangerous Rock Island Rapids. While passing what is now called Campbell's Island, the wind came up and blew Campbell's boat to shore. "This boat the Great Spirit gave us," according to Black Hawk's account in his autobiography. "We advanced to the river's bank and commenced firing at the boat. I encouraged my braves to continue firing. I prepared my bow and arrows to throw fire to the sail, which was lying on the boat, and after 2 or 3 attempts, succeeded in setting the sail on fire." The boat was soon in flames. One of the boats that had passed returned, dropped anchor, and swung in close to the boat on fire, and took off all the people except those killed and badly wounded, Black Hawk related. They did not return fire. I therefore ordered a rush to the boat. When we got near, they fired and killed two of our people, being all that we lost in the engagement. Some of their men jumped out and pushed off the boat and thus got away without losing a man. I had a good opinion of this war chief, Lieutenant Campbell. He managed so much better than the others. It would give me pleasure to shake him by the hand. In September, U.S. Army Major Zachary Taylor was sent with a fleet of 8 protected keelboats and 334 men to destroy Black Hawk's village and uproot the crops. According to accounts written by historian Hauberg, as the fleet approached the mouth of the Rock River at the Mississippi, the wind shifted and reached gale proportions. They put in at Pelican Island and were attacked by Indians and British 6-pound cannon and swivel guns. The expedition fled back to St. Louis. All of these Western military activities led to the construction of Fort Armstrong in 1816. It was abandoned in 1836 after Indian warfare died down, and from 1840 to 1845 was an ordnance depot. In 1861, efforts began in earnest to build a national arsenal on the island. It was approved by President Abraham Lincoln in July 1862. And this article, part of the Bicentennial series, was written by Roger Ruthart, a former editor of the Dispatch, the Rock Island Argus. He was recently inducted into the Lincoln League of Journalists. And continuing on the front page from the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, workplace woes often even worse. Injuries at poultry processing plants underreported. This from Champaign. Meat and poultry processing workers often perform the same motions for hours at a time, pulling tenders off of chicken carcasses, tearing out their internal organs, or trimming cuts of meat. These repetitive and forceful jobs, performed on long shifts with minimal breaks, can cause workers to develop musculoskeletal injuries, including carpal tunnel syndrome, tendonitis, muscle strains, and lower back injuries. These injuries are common in poultry processing, but statistically, they are often invisible due to the way the Occupational Safety and Health Administration collects data. And this problem isn't limited to just musculoskeletal injuries. The injury rate in the poultry processing industry is already higher than many other industries. Yet the rate would be higher still if not for faulty data collection methods and widespread underreporting problems across the meat and poultry processing industry, according to a 2016 Government Accountability Office report. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration requires workplaces to report severe injuries to the agency within 24 hours. These severe injuries include amputations, loss of an eye, and inpatient hospitalizations. OSHA does not require employers to report minor injuries that receive first aid treatment. If a team member gets hurt on the job, we request they report it, regardless of how minor they believe it to be, said Derek Burleson, public relations manager with Tyson Foods, Inc., the largest poultry processor in the country. We do this because we believe in early intervention to reduce frequency and severity of injuries, Burleson said. We want workplace injuries and illnesses detected early so they can be immediately addressed. Employers are required to report only injuries and illnesses that force employees to take days off from work. So if a worker is placed on work restriction or is transferred to a different job, that injury doesn't have to be reported to OSHA. According to the 2016 GAO report, Many workers who suffer from musculoskeletal disorders are transferred to a different job or are restricted from their job without getting days off. There is also no specific way to record a musculoskeletal injury to Occupational Safety and Health Administration because the OSHA logs, the forms employers are required to fill out when an injury occurs, do not have a section to report these types of injuries, unless an employer states it on an incident report. OSHA logs are not consistently sent to OSHA or the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the agency responsible for collecting data on labor-related issues, so there is no specified way to compile data on this type of injury. It's very hard now to show the degree of musculoskeletal injuries, said Lance Compa, senior lecturer at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and author of a 2005 Human Rights Watch report describing the alarming working conditions plaguing the industry. If someone stabs themselves or gets stabbed by a coworker on accident and has to go to the hospital, something that's obvious and there are witnesses and everybody knows what's happened, that will be reported, Compa said. But the typical repetitive stress injury doesn't get reported anymore. Before 2001, OSHA logs had a column for employers to report repeated traumas. This included some musculoskeletal injuries and hearing loss. In 2001, OSHA created two separate columns on its logs, one for musculoskeletal injuries and one for hearing loss. The column for musculoskeletal injuries was never implemented and it was deleted altogether in 2003, according to a 2016 GAO report. Moderately severe injuries, injuries that receive treatment by the plant's medical staff and do not result in job transfer or restriction or time away from work, are not reported because they are not severe enough, according to Jessica Leibler, an environmental health professor at Boston University, who has been conducting research on workers in the animal and food industries for more than 10 years. I was surprised by how many workers reported moderately severe injuries that were not severe enough to keep them from going to work, but certainly affected their quality of life, Leibler said. Employees are our most important asset, and their safety is of paramount importance, said the National Chicken Council, a national nonprofit organization that lobbies on behalf of the chicken industry, in a press release regarding declining injury rates. The GAO recommended OSHA consider conducting off-site interviews or find other ways to receive complaints anonymously, to encourage workers to speak up about their conditions and injuries, Barnes said. Underreporting is typically a result of workers' fear of retaliation by employers. This retaliation can mean punishment, ranging up to job loss, or even deportation for workers who are undocumented, Leibler said. Employers can also suppress reporting to avoid OSHA inspections. What we are finding is that a lot of the workers are afraid, said Cindy Brown Barnes, Director of Education, Workforce, and Income Security Issues for the GAO. The whole fear of retaliation prevented them, in some cases, at least they told us, from really speaking up or at least being very open and honest about the conditions they were facing. The poultry processing industry has devised a way to track employee behavior. It's called the point system. Points are added for things like missing a shift because of injury or illness. These systems are common throughout the poultry processing industry, according to a Northwest Arkansas Workers' Justice Center report. In Alabama, for example, 97% of poultry processing workers interviewed for a 2013 Southern Poverty Law Center report said there was a point system at their jobs. Critics have said these point systems discourage workers from taking breaks and time off of work to address health needs. A lack of sick days and the use of attendance-driven point systems force workers to choose between their health and their employment, reads the testimony of a poultry worker in the same Arkansas report. OSHA requires trained healthcare professionals to work at every workplace to provide first aid treatment for workers that is not near a hospital or healthcare clinic. According to a 2016 GAO report, these medical units often treat surface wounds and drain blisters, among other things. But some OSHA officials have expressed concerns over both access to and quality of the medical units within many meat and poultry processing plants. According to a 2017 GAO report, some medical units were found to offer first aid treatments, such as providing over-the-counter painkillers or ointments, when they should have been referring injured or ill workers to a doctor. The nonprofit news outlet of the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting provided this article to the Associated Press through a collaboration with the Institute for Nonprofit News. And moving to the local and state page, retirement program phase-in begins. A new state program will automatically deduct money from the paychecks of about 1.2 million Illinois residents for retirement savings. The move could reduce the use of food stamps, Medicaid, and other publicly funded social programs, said Illinois Treasurer Michael Frericks. Illinois Secure Choice is being phased in more than 3 years after becoming law. The state-sponsored retirement program works with certain businesses with 25 or more employees. The businesses will be connected with a financial firm that will provide ways for workers to build retirement savings with after-tax cash deducted from each paycheck for a Roth individual retirement account. Workers will be eligible for automatic enrollment, 5% of gross pay being deducted and placed in a retirement fund. Enrollees will be able to switch savings rates and retirement funds or can opt out of the program. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce opposed it, calling it a poor substitute for typical employer-provided retirement plans. 8 businesses have volunteered to be in the Secure Choice pilot program, Frerich said. All companies with 25 or more workers must be part of the program or contract directly with firms that handle employee retirement accounts by November 2019. Illinois is the second state in the U.S. to participate in such an initiative. And Tony Reed writes from Decatur, Ice Cream Safari at Scoville. Ice cream and frozen fish ice cubes help beat the heat at event. The heat was on Sunday, but Scoville Zoo had it covered with something for everyone. Ice cream for the human bipeds and goodies like frozen fish ice cubes for the Humboldt penguins. The penguins were kind of scared of them, said Ken Fry, the zoo's director, but we had a big 5-gallon bucket of frozen fruit for the camels. They liked that. And the tortoises just get blocks of ice cubes. They love to chew those ice cubes and get misted. They love to be misted. Sunday marked the zoo's annual ice cream safari, a tradition stretching back more than a dozen years. Visitors braving temperatures in the upper 80s enjoyed watching the animals cool down with specialized treats while lapping up some cool fare of their own. Ice cream stations set up around the zoo handed out free cones in chocolate, vanilla, cookies and cream, strawberry, and orange sherbet. Some 48 gallons of ice cream had been donated by Prairie Farms Dairy, and it disappeared fast as a packed zoo parking lot spoke to the throng of visitors making the attraction their family day out. I was kind of worried today weather-wise, because there was a chance of storms, and also heat-wise, but I'm very happy that all these people turned out for our ice cream safari, Fry said. And continuing another Scoville Zoo tradition, the ice cream stations were manned by officers, deputies, support staff, and family members associated with the Macon County Sheriff's Office. Lieutenant Jeff Shibley, in charge of patrol, commanded one station with Deputy Seth Major and Shively's 19-year-old son, Nicholas. "It's fun for us, and it kind of shows people that cops are people, too," Jeff Shively said. "We've also got stickers and coloring books for the kids, and we're handing them out as well. I tell you, this event is one of those things where we put out the sign-up sheet to come out and volunteer, and we never have to twist arms to get our guys out there." Among the visitors heading for Shively's ice cream station was Abby Cohen, who came all the way from Pena to enjoy the zoo and the ice cream with children Delilah Denton, 3, and Desmond Denton, 5, along with grandmother Heather Leban. "We've been to the zoo before, but we've not done the ice cream safari," said Cohen, 23, having just plucked Delilah off the zoo's merry-go-round. "We came over today for family time, and the kids like the playground nearby and all the animals." Stepping out into the steamy heat, Cohen also gave thanks for another Scoville Zoo attraction. "And it's not too big. Oh man, that is like one of the best parts." And two pictures accompany this article. One of a little boy eating a strawberry ice cone that's dripping down his arm. Leon Frazier, 3, mounts a concerted attack on a strawberry ice cream cone. Leon was visiting Scoville Zoo's ice cream safari on Sunday with his 5-year-old sister, Faye, and their mom, Grace Frazier. "I like this zoo," said Grace Frazier, who lives in Mount Zion. "It's good kid family activity." And the other photograph shows a little girl hiding her face looking at a black goat. 2-year-old Natalie Thomas, safe in the arms of her dad, Mike Thomas, comes face to face with a goat at Scoville Zoo on Sunday. "It was all a bit nerve-wracking, but there was plenty of ice cream available during the zoo's ice cream safari to cool Natalie's disposition. And she'll probably be on a sugar high the rest of the afternoon," said her dad. And from Decatur, "Most motorcyclists keep driver from fleeing." A group of motorcyclists prevented a driver from fleeing the scene of an accident Saturday night that left one of the riders with broken bones, the Macon County Sheriff's Office said. According to a news release from the Sheriff's Office, a 46-year-old male Danville resident was traveling eastbound in a 2000 Cadillac passenger car when he tried to merge into a group of eastbound motorcycles at the entrance to a construction zone along Interstate 72 near mile marker 148. The incident was reported at 7:15 p.m. While merging, the Cadillac struck the rear tire of one of the motorcycles, causing the rider to crash, the release said. Once the driver of the Cadillac stopped his vehicle, other motorcyclists in the group approached the driver and indicated to authorities they could tell the driver had been consuming alcoholic beverages and felt he was under the influence. When the driver of the Cadillac got back into his car and was attempting to leave the scene, the other motorcyclists were able to get the keys away from the driver to prevent him from leaving prior to the arrival of deputies. The release said the driver of the Cadillac was subsequently arrested for aggravated driving under the influence, felony driving with a revoked driver's license, and several other traffic violations. He was booked into the Macon County Jail, where he will remain awaiting setting of bond by a judge today. The injured driver of the motorcycle, a 76-year-old Champaign resident, was transported to Decatur Memorial Hospital, where he is being treated for some broken bones. The injuries weren't believed to be life-threatening. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, July 16th, 2018. Please stay tuned.